So last week I told the story of being in a gym boys restaurant and having a young woman approach me and ask me to tell her about Jesus. And in that story, I recounted how I didn't know how to answer a question. And as I sat there with this dumbfounded look on my face, and she, I'm sure, was shocked that the priest didn't know how to tell her about Jesus, I said last week that she threw me a bone. She simplified things a little bit, made it a little more concrete, and said, well then, could you tell me about how you became a Christian? So what I'd like to do this morning is pick up the story there and tell the story about how I became a Christian, and then go from there to talk more about how I've learned to answer that question, to talk about Jesus. But first, and my understanding of God and Jesus is really grounded in my first encounter, my foundational encounter with Jesus. Now, when I was growing up, I wasn't raised going to church. I like to say that my family never went to church, but that wasn't true. My family, actually, I was the third of four children, and when I was a baby, we went to church as a family. My dad was in the Air Force, and we moved around, and wherever we were stationed, we would go to the Air Force Base chapel. And then when I was, like, this big, my family stopped going to church because I was too much trouble in church. And I was just too active and I wouldn't settle down, so my parents just gave up on the whole church thing. So I am responsible for the religious downfall of my family. None of that's in my own memory. Like, I have no memory of going to church. So in my mind, when I grew up, my family didn't go to church. Our first encounter with anything spiritual was when I was in seventh grade living in Belchertown, Massachusetts. My father, who was a colonel in the Air Force at this time, came home and declared to the family that we needed to learn how to meditate. And I'm pretty sure that he must have read an article in Popular Science magazine that talked about the benefits of meditation, because he was a pretty much of a science guy. And he would only do this for, like, scientific reasons, but, you know, we needed to learn to meditate. So the whole family piled into the Rambler station wagon and drove to Amherst, Massachusetts, to the Transcendental Meditation Center, where there was this white wooden house with a photograph of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in each room, and we were each given a private meditation teacher, and we sat down with our meditation teacher and were taught to meditate. And then meditation became part of our family chores. And we were to meditate 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening. And like if it was dinner time, Mom would say to us, kids, have you guys meditated yet? And we'd go, oh, no, we haven't. We'd all run down to the basement for, you know, do our meditation for 20 minutes and then go on with our day. And that lasted a little over a year. That sort of family practice of meditation, and then we moved and got distracted by other things. But what that did for me is it gave me this hyperactive boy. It gave me this quiet place that I knew how to access. And ever since, I've been sort of in and out of periods of being disciplined about meditation and not disciplined about meditation. But it was always a tool that I was given when I was a teenager. And then a couple years, and then we moved from Massachusetts to Virginia, and it was in my sophomore year in high school that I met Andrea. It was her freshman year in high school. We were both on the track team together. We were both 15, and we started dating. And then it was Andrea's idea to go to West Point. So I went to West Point when I graduated high school, a year ahead of her, because that's where she wanted to go to school. And then the following year, she came to West Point. And so my sophomore year at West Point, oh, I left out a part. When I was in high school, can't remember, freshman or sophomore year, my older sister dropped out of college and joined the Moonies. And this was in the 70s when the religious cults were a big deal. And she was in Europe. She was in England. She joined the Moonies. And it was sort of our family's introduction to organized religion. And we went to the library. We did all kinds of research about the Moonies and how religious cults functioned. And that sort of turned me off to the whole idea of religion, because we were pretty displeased, heartbroken over what was happening with my sister. So then I go to West Point. My second year, Andrea joins me at West Point, and she sings in the choir. She sings in the Protestant choir at the Protestant chapel at West Point, and I would earn points with my girlfriend if I went to church. So the choir sat up in the chancel, and the choir would sit on the right side of the chancel, so I would sit in the front pew right here so Andrea would see me, because why go to church unless I'm going to get credit? So I would sit there so that Andrea could see me, and I went because I wanted to impress my girlfriend. I did not go because I was interested in Jesus or God or any of that craziness. And at the time, you know, I was kind of pissed off at God because of my sister and religion. Like, just plus, I was 19, and I needed to rebel against something. And it was too costly to rebel against West Point. So it was much easier to rebel against God. So I went to church, but like I was like, la, 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 la. I'm not going to listen to anything. I just wasn't interested at all. And we have a mutual friend, a good friend of ours, Sue Sowers, who was very evangelical and was a friend of Andrea's and got Andrea all hooked on Jesus. And then Andrea started talking to me about Jesus, and I was like, la, 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 la. I'm not interested at all. And I just kept pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And there were ways in which, like in hindsight, there were ways in which I saw God change, like saving my life. There were ways in which God was showing up in my life. But at the time, I was having none of it. I was just pushing it away, pushing it away. And then months later, Maundy Thursday rolls around. And Maundy Thursday is the service during Holy Week, the day during Holy Week when we remember the Last Supper. And at the chapel at West Point, they do something special for Maundy Thursday. They do this thing called the Living Last Supper. And what they do is they have up on the chancel this large table set up, like, you know, a Last Supper table. And 12 cadets come in dressed like the 12 disciples, and one cadet comes in dressed like Jesus. And Jesus says, tonight one of you is going to betray me. And then the 12 disciples freeze as if, you know, as Da Vinci painted them. And then they came alive one at a time and told their story. And they told their story, their engagement with Jesus. And then they ended their story, each of them, by asking the question, is it I? Am I the one who's going to betray Jesus? You hear this story after story after story. And then Chaplain Camp, the Baptist chaplain, got in the pulpit and preached this story, a sermon titled, Is It I? And it sort of invites the question about, for us to think about the ways in which we betray Jesus. Now, Andrea's up in the choir. I'm sitting about two-thirds back with Sue Sowers, our evangelical friend. And she's telling me this whole story of the Last Supper and the crucifixion. And it was a story that I'd never really heard before. And she's telling me this story, and I'm hearing this sermon about the disciples asking, is it I? And I become like immediately aware of the many ways that I have been pushing God away and giving God the finger and like saying no, and how in the midst of that, I had this profound sense of being loved. And it wasn't being loved because I had changed. It was a sense of being loved even in the midst of my rebellion and my betrayal. And then what I did was something I'd never done before. I prayed, and as I was praying, I felt this sense of the Spirit in me, and then Sue and I got in line for communion, and I'd never taken communion before, and Andrea was up in the choir, and she saw me in line, and she came and joined me in the communion line, and we knelt together at the altar rail, and Chaplain Camp had the presence of mind to let Andrea feed me my first communion as we were both weeping. So I had this powerful, powerful, powerful conversion experience. And for me, what's an important piece of that story is the sense I had of God's love. And it was love that was not dependent on me changing my mind about God. It was love I knew that had been there all along. I have this foundational experience that God is love, and God loves you, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can't get away from it. Can't change God's mind so that God doesn't love you anymore. Now that became the lens through which I looked at everything else. Like for me, that was my rock foundation. And if it was love, then maybe it's of God. But if it's not love, it's definitely not of God. It's definitely not true. Which became a challenge for me, became a problem. Because there was a fair amount of stuff I was hearing in Christian theology that didn't sound like love. And I really wrestled with, what does this mean? Because I know what I know. And what I know is God is love. And I kept coming up against these teachings. Like, if you're not a Christian, if you don't accept Jesus, you're going to burn in hell for eternity. And I wrestled with that because I knew that God's love for me preceded my change of heart. So that was like a rub for me. It didn't fit. So I had this conversion experience, fell in love with Jesus, did Bible study all the time. Andrew and I got very intensely involved in the Christian community at West Point. And the Christian community at West Point was amazing. It was profound and intense, and I think part of why it was so amazing was because the environment was hostile. I mean, it was a harsh, brutal environment, in some ways a depersonalizing environment, and Christian community was the one place where you could let your guard down and sort of hold on to each other for dear life. And it was my, like, because the world revolves around me, and it still does, by the way, but... You know, I was thinking, like, blowing things out of proportion, this must be exactly what it was like in the early church, in this hostile environment, where coming together as Christians was this place of safety and sanctuary before you sort of go out into this cold, cruel world. But that was my experience. Like, what it meant to be Christian community was to be honest and authentic and to have each other's backs. And that became the foundation, like, that's what I expect the church to be. That became my foundational understanding of the church. So then I graduated from West Point. We were stationed in Hawaii. And we went to an Episcopal church because Andrea was raised in the Episcopal church. So that was our default starting point. And I go to Episcopal church expecting this sort of intense, authentic, holding on to each other for dear life community that I had at West Point. And I walk into my first Episcopal church, and everyone in the room, first of all, is ancient. Like 50. And I'm walking in 22 going, well, this doesn't seem to fit, and it's not the same, and blah, blah, blah. So I'm going through my own little crisis. And what Andrea and I end up doing is we become leaders of the high school youth group because they're all in existential crisis. They're all looking, you know, and they were much closer to our age than, you know, the ancient 50-year-olds in the church. So we created this really intense community with the high school youth group. And that was our introduction to ministry. And that was sort of where I began to think about doing something different with my life than being in the Army. But what really drove me to seminary was the dissonance between what was in my heart and what I knew to be true, which was God is love,
and so much of the Christian theology that I was hearing that didn't seem to be very loving. And I was at a point in my life where I had to know if I was on the right spiritual path. I didn't want to waste time, like another 10 or 15 years, and then wake up and realize that I chose wrong and that I was on the wrong spiritual path. I needed to find out if following Jesus within the Christian church, I fell in love with Jesus and Jesus' teachings. It was the church I was wrestling with. And I didn't know if I could fit in the church, like if I could have integrity with my tender heart and my sense of God as love and give my heart to the church. So I figured, and I was too embarrassed to like ask my priest, because I figured everyone in church went to Sunday school and they all knew this stuff, and I was the only person that was having trouble seeing how this all fit together. And instead of embarrassing myself by asking the priest, I would just go to seminary. Like in my mind, that was the easier thing to do. Go to seminary and sit in the back row and sort of listen to what they're saying. So I went to seminary, half to sort of test out this vocation of the priesthood, but the other half really to see if I fit or if the church fit me. And if it did, I would give my life to it. If it didn't, I was going to move on and find the place where I fit. And what ended up happening, I went to Virginia Seminary, which is an Episcopal seminary in Alexandria, Virginia, which was near our parents, which is why we went there to be home for a few years. Went to Virginia Seminary, and I realized that the Episcopal Church was much more open and supple, and that there was this place like for God of love, like God of love fits in the Episcopal Church. And I realized when I was at Virginia Seminary that theologically I had come home. Like this does fit. I didn't know yet if being a priest fit. My major at West Point was, engineering mechanics and computer science. And I had an engineer's brain. Truth was absolute. It was found on a calculator. And I didn't read books, didn't write papers, I was terrified to speak in front of people, and all of the things you need to do to be successful as a priest, I didn't do any of it, nor did I like have any capacity to do any of it. So seminary was really hard, and the first few years of being a priest was really hard. I sort of went through a DNA change, and a couple years into being a priest, I realized I was home. And that this vocation, this ministry of pastoral care and preaching and teaching, that was my calling. So that's a piece. That's probably longer than my burrito conversation with this woman at Jim Boy's when she asked, how did you get connected with the church? That's a piece of the story that I told her. And then I mentioned last week that after this burrito conversation, this can you tell me about Jesus conversation, the Baptist minister in my church, Bud Swank, came up to me and said, you need to tell people why it's necessary to believe in Jesus. So I started wrestling with the question of why was it necessary for me as a priest, as a human, to believe in Jesus. And there was a part of me that was yearning for a do-over with this Jim Boy's woman. Right? Like, what would I say, and wouldn't it be great if I had another opportunity? Will I ever get another opportunity? And that's when I knew I had to be careful what I prayed for, because what happened next was I got a visit from two people who ran a yoga studio. And I had been involved in my previous job in Idaho, been involved with teaching with Tibetan Buddhists. And when I got to Sacramento, I was invited to teach in a yoga studio, do a joint teaching with a Buddhist monk that had seen a teaching that I had done in New York City. So Lama Marut called me and said, would you join me at this yoga studio? And we did a teaching in this yoga studio. And then a couple of weeks later, Anne Marie and Bill, the owners of this yoga studio, came to me in my office. And they said, we do an intensive 200-hour yoga teacher training, where people who want to be yoga teachers come to our studio and we teach them how to do that. and then they get licensed to be yoga teachers. And we teach them about Tibetan Buddhism as part of our program, but there are some of them that are Christians that are wrestling with, can you be a Christian and do yoga? And all of them, if they're yoga teachers, are going to have Christians in their classes. So it would be helpful if they knew something about Christianity. So could you come tell them about Jesus? And they gave me 2 hours. They gave me a 2-hour slot in their 200-hour teacher training. They gave me 2 hours to sit down and talk to them about Jesus. So I then had like my do-over to really think through. If I'm going to talk to people who don't know anything about the church or might be church phobic, how am I going to articulate Christianity to them? And what ended up happening is I walk in this room and there are 35 young adults in this room. None of them know a priest is coming to talk to them. A priest comes in and they're there to learn how to be yoga teachers, and this priest sits down and starts talking to them about Jesus. Now they're all uncomfortable and half of them are angry. Like, why do I have to listen to this priest? So I had this hostel, it was a hostel room, and I got to do this 2-hour talk. And part of what I want to do in my next couple of sermons is talk about, sort of answer that question. Talk about who is God, what is it like, how are we broken, what is sin, what is salvation, what does it mean to be saved by Jesus, why do we believe in the Trinity, what good is that? But to talk about, to give an overview of a Christian worldview from my perspective, which isn't the only perspective, it's just the best perspective. I'll tell you a little bit, sort of unpack how I answer that question in a longer format. And this morning, let me tell you just a little bit about God, about my understanding of God. When I first became a Christian, the kind of image of God that landed for me was sort of the guy in the clouds that does the stuff. And if we pray right, then maybe some stuff will be done for us. So that was my sort of basic, primitive understanding of God. And in the 40 years since, my understanding of God has become, it's much less concrete. Like, it's less simple. Like, I don't have an image of God that is that I can like package and put in my back pocket anymore. My sense of God is much more mysterious and diffuse. And one of the things I believe to be true about Anglicanism is that we believe that God is mystery with a capital M. God is mystery. And our goal isn't to understand God. Our goal is to encounter God and to be in love with God and to be one with God, and to see the world through the eyes of God. So my understanding of God, what God is, has become much more diffuse. My faith in God has become much more solid. Like, I know God is. I just don't know what God is. Now, unfortunately, God, like the word God is not helpful. Because when I say the word God, everyone has a different idea of what that means. And when I say the word God as a priest in front of a room of yogis, what they think I mean by God is certainly probably different, right, than what I mean by God. They think I'm talking about the guy in the clouds that does the stuff. And I mean, so it's like, it's almost a useless word, right? Because if everyone thinks a word means something different, then it's not really helpful. But we don't have many other words. I'll talk about Trinity next week, about why that's awesome. But for me, how I understand God, a key fact. I graduated from high school in 1979. Why is that important when we talk about God? Star Wars. Star Wars came out in 1978. So I was an impressionable high school student when I saw Star Wars for the first time. And this notion of the Force, right? This notion of there being this force of good and positiveness, this positive energy that is in creation, that sort of landed in me. Like, there's this sense of positiveness. So for me, as my sense of God became more diffuse, what it began to resonate, and I think it sort of fits more with the Holy Spirit part of the Trinity, but there is this force of life that is pulsing through the world that will not be denied, such that after every forest fire, right, there's the color purple, and there are new flowers, and that resurrection is just a pattern. There's just life after death. And so for me, God is this force of life that pulses through creation. God is this force of love that speaks to the better angels of our nature, the still, small voice that is in us, that is drawing the arc of the moral universe toward justice and wholeness, that God is the gravitational pull, that God is the ground of all being, the ground of all existence. I can talk in those sort of vague terms about God, but I can't talk in concrete terms. Like, God is this force of energy and life and love. And for me, one of the mysteries that I've wrestled with mightily is the notion of Trinity. And why the Trinity, like that made no sense to me. Why three? Why not seven? Why did they make up that number? And I'll talk, I don't want this sermon to last 2 hours, which is what the yogis gave me, but Episcopalians won't sit still for that long. So I'll pick this up next week and talking about the Trinity next week. But then I want to talk about, so I believe, I have really thick rose-colored glasses, and I really believe that we are created to be in holy communion with one another. And I really believe that we're created to be in holy communion with God. And I believe that there is a part of us, there's a way in which we are that. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. I believe that. There's a part of me that believes that's really true and real. Then there's the part of me that lives in the real world where I see how broken we are. And part of what I want to talk about next week is our brokenness. And talk about brokenness and our paralysis in ways that come alive for you, so that when we talk about the ways Jesus saves us from our brokenness and paralysis, it makes sense. So I remember years ago, I was teaching an introductory class on Christianity, and each week we had a different facet of Christianity, and on Sin Week, I wrote sin up on a board, and this older gentleman walked in, and saw it on the board, and he goes, "Finally, something I know something about." So next week, I want to talk a little bit about Trinity. I want to sort of unpack this idea of sin, which I love, and how sin can really, understanding our brokenness and our paralysis as humans, can help us live with less judgment and more love with one another. So we'll talk about that, and then we'll talk about sort of ways in which Jesus saves us.